You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out this week. Coming up, following a study on wolf hunting and poaching, our guest makes the case that culling plays a vital role in good conservation. But first, the musical Hamilton swept the Tony Awards last night, taking home 11 Tonys at the end of the night. Ron Chernow's mammoth biography started the ball rolling and inspired the eventual Broadway smash by Lin-Manuel Miranda. Today, Alexander Hamilton is seen as one of the coolest founding fathers, and his life story, from his humble origins to his fateful duel with Aaron Burr, makes studying history anything but dull. Our next guest is a Hamilton historian from here in Wisconsin. Eugene Testall joins us now. He's an assistant professor of history at UW-Platteville. Eugene, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks a lot, Veronica.
So what first got you into Alexander Hamilton?
Well, as you say, while I and many other historians don't always use the term founding fathers for a host of reasons, Hamilton himself, and especially his beloved Eliza, were some of those who absolutely adored that phrase, because Hamilton was very concerned throughout most of his life, and Eliza, well beyond his life, worked for his legacy to have him be a name that would be remembered. And so when we study early American history, some of these names from the American Revolution, names like Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, and Marquis de Lafayette, and Alexander Hamilton, these are names that come to mind.
There is something, it seems like, especially compelling about Hamilton's story, at least certainly in the Broadway version, but that duel with Aaron Burr is one factor, his humble origins. What is it, do you think, about that story that makes such good fodder for the stage and is just compelling to learn about?
Sure. Well, one thing I often like to say is that history is often stranger than fiction, and that's part of why we historians study it. And Miranda clearly already found that to be true in Chernow's work and other historians, and has then found Hamilton's story to be, again, stranger than fiction in his own writing. And so part of why I think this is such a compelling, moving, gripping, exciting musical is that the story of Alexander Hamilton is all of that. Also, what you said about what makes it good for theater, it's a rags-to-riches story. It has sex out of wedlock. It has war. It has spies. It has all these things that make for excellent drama.
So you mentioned that rags-to-riches part. Tell us more about that. Where did he come from?
Sure. Well, Alexander Hamilton was born on the island of Nevis in the British West Indies in 1757. And as the character Aaron Burr in Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton says at the beginning of the piece and at other times, how does the bastard son of a whore become all these things, that gripping turn of phrase, in fact, that is Miranda's, but it comes from a statement that John Adams wrote to Benjamin Rush just 2 years after Hamilton was killed, where he said to think part of the legacy of Washington would be, quote, changed, quote, by a bastard brat of a Scotch peddler. So that much, many of us might feel that, most of that is just Manuel's, Lin-Manuel Miranda's brilliance, but part of that is ripped from this private correspondence of John Adams. And again, I think that's why not only has Miranda shown himself to be a very artful singer, producer, director, writer, even with his In the Heights in the late 90s, but here again, part of what makes this even more compelling, many would say, than In the Heights, is that he not only draws from personal experience and his love of hip-hop, but then he takes some of this history almost directly from primary documentation, which, again, for historians like me, gets us very excited and also then carries some of the important lessons of this early period of American history with it.
We're talking about the life of Alexander Hamilton right now with Eugene Tesdall, Assistant Professor of History at UW-Platteville. And it's always fun when you think about history and the figures that you learn about there to think about them as people. So if you were to describe Alexander Hamilton as somebody you knew, maybe a friend, how would you describe him to us?
Right. Well, this is, again, part of what Miranda gets right about Hamilton. As this is a piece of pop culture, invariably there's going to be romanticization and perhaps even dramatization, and Miranda has done that, but a lot of this is who Hamilton was. He was an obscure, illegitimate child from the Caribbean. He did make it to New York City in the fall of 1773 as an 18-year-old who had little more in his pocket than a letter of recommendation from a Presbyterian Reverend, Hugh Knox. And he thought that was going to get him into Princeton, the College of New Jersey. Instead, it didn't, and he soon found himself enrolled at King's College, which would soon or later become known as Columbia University. And so here again, these are things that many of my students here at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville and most of us, the theater-going public, we can relate to this, right? Hamilton didn't get into the first college he applied to, right? He started studying medicine and then decided to gravitate towards the law. So especially when talking about Hamilton to college students, we see that, unsurprisingly, they can relate much more to someone like Hamilton than, say, royalty or a flawless military strategist.
Well, we can't let you go without talking about that duel, that fateful duel with Aaron Burr. I mean, it seems kind of crazy just to think about it. Here's two influential, powerful figures in American government and, you know, history, politics at the time, and they duel. Can you tell us what happened that day and a little bit about how we got there? We probably don't have time for the complete story, but in essence, what happened?
Sure. So the musical also dramatizes this, and again, it doesn't need a lot of improvement, embellishment. So after the careers of Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton had intertwined for over two decades, on at dawn of July 11th, 1804, Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton and their seconds rode across to Weehawken, New Jersey, and there the quick story is Aaron Burr shot and killed the former Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton. We do know, while speculation as to what actually was happening started almost instantly, we do know today that Hamilton fired first, that he fired at a branch about 20 feet above Burr's head. We think he meant to scare him. Perhaps he did scare Burr, and Burr, we think, probably meant to only glance off the right side or left side of Hamilton. But when he did, it ricocheted off a rib and then would kill him the next day under his doctor's care. And ultimately, this untimely death and the most famous duel in American history is part of why many people, like myself, have bothered to remember Hamilton. Had he become president, as he probably would have liked, or had his career not been marred by scandal, and ending in this dramatic duel, perhaps we wouldn't have this really moving and brilliant piece by Lin-Manuel Miranda today.
Eugene, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, and have a great day.
You too. That was Eugene Tesdahl, Assistant Professor of History at UW-Platteville, talking about the life and influence of Alexander Hamilton. And he's got a public lecture on Hamilton at the Carnegie Stout Library in Dubuque, Iowa, coming up. It's on Tuesday, July 11th at 6 p.m. on the 212th anniversary of that infamous duel that we were just talking about. The Broadway musical Hamilton picked up 11 Tony Awards this past Sunday.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship to King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is a lot of brains, but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with that.
I'm Veronica Rigger, and this is Central Time.
A shining piece of coal, trying to reach my goal. My power of speech, unimpeachable. Only 19, but my mind.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, following the deadly Orlando attack this weekend, we'll talk about the convergence of terrorism and mass shootings. First, a couple weeks ago, we talked to a researcher who looked at the policy of wolf hunting and how it impacted poaching cases. He and a partner published a study that said allowing wolf hunting in Wisconsin and Michigan correlated with the rise in poaching incidents. Wolf hunting is a major issue here in Wisconsin, and certain biologists have taken issue with those recent findings. Last week, my co-host, Rob Ferret, sat down with Adrian Wideven to talk about that issue. Adrian is a certified wildlife biologist who headed up the Wisconsin DNR Wolf Recovery and Conservation Programs from the years 1990 to 2003. He was also the senior editor of the book Recovery of Gray Wolves in the Great Lakes Region of the United States.
A couple weeks ago, we talked about a study saying wolf culling, they teased out the numbers here, and they made the case that it could lead to ultimately more poaching. So what are your thoughts on that? What do you see when you look at the numbers over the last bunch of years?
Well, I headed up the wolf program for many years and looked at a lot of those data and did some analysis with Eric Olson, a professor here at Northland College, and we came up with different results. Our results suggested that when some kind of public culling was allowed, when wolves that were causing problems were removed by government trappers or people were issued permits to allow them to remove problem wolves, that we saw a decline in illegal kill. And ours was more of a direct measure. We're looking at radio-collared wolves when they died, and we found that the rate of illegal kill seemed to be much lower during the periods that there's some kind of culling allowed and was higher during periods that they're completely protected by the federal government.
Yeah, this other study I mentioned, it involved UW researcher Adrian Trevis, who we talked to. They were going for more of an indirect approach. They said, I think they're making the case that we may not know when wolves are poached, so they're trying to get an overall population measure. What do you think about the strengths or weaknesses of trying to get at poaching numbers in that way?
Well, one of the problems that they're dealing with is that they looked at 8 years of very rapid population growth. And if you think in terms of a wildlife population, then when it first hits the landscape, it goes through kind of these phases that initially there's few of the animals around and there's a very slow growth rate. And then they hit kind of a period where they grow very rapidly. And after a while, the population again starts to slow down as it starts to approach the carrying capacity. So if you incorporate that period of very rapid growth, which was also the period that wolves were federally listed, it gives you kind of an inflated value of how fast that population, of how great they're growing, but it's do more to just how populations grow than the kind of controls in place. So I think it gives you kind of a misleading indication that this population is growing very well because they're protected. Well, they're protected, but it's also because that's the phase of the growth of the population you're looking at.
I think one thing everybody in this conversation probably agrees with is that we don't want poaching, illegal poaching, I guess it's a redundant phrase. Have we seen poaching in any stage of the game here with wolves to such an extent that it's having an impact on wolf population numbers?
It probably did in the early years. We started monitoring the wolf population about in fall of 1979. So our first count was for winter 1980. And through the early 1980s, the population was actually declining in Wisconsin, even though they were federally protected endangered species. Parvovirus was perhaps a factor at the time, a new canid disease, but we also measured very high levels of illegal kill. So that did seem to be reducing the growth of the wolf population. I believe there's places in Europe where Finland has seen these experiences where illegal kill has been so high that it's reduced the population growth at times. I believe that's been seen in Poland and some other locations. So there are times where illegal kill can be at such a rate that it actually controls or reduces the size of a population of wolves.
So the hope among conservationists, I guess, is that by allowing culls, government culling of wolves, or maybe specific licenses to target problem wolves, ones that are attacking livestock, for example, that will reduce the incentive, the motivation for poaching. Is that right?
That's right. And we've seen indications of that, that when we have had these culls in place, we get only half the rate amongst radio-collared wolves that are dying from illegal killing versus time periods when there are no cullings in effect. So it seems that people are taking matters into their own hands, or they're frustrated with the fact that there's no controls in place, and we're seeing higher rates of that illegal killing.
We're talking to certified wildlife biologist Adrian Weideven about wolves culling, hunting wolves, and poaching. Adrian, in a paper you co-wrote, you point toward maybe a bigger problem not being one specific policy, but rapid changes in policy when it comes to wolf hunting or culling. What can you spell that out for us?
Well, what we saw in Wisconsin, the Great Lakes region, is that we've gone through these swings in management authority, which has been created a lot of concern and a lot of negative attitudes toward wolves that we're seeing. In 2003, wolves were downlisted from federally endangered to a threatened species, giving the state more management fluctuation. And then it went back to federally endangered 2005, was delisted in 2007, relisted in 2008, delisted in 2009, relisted in 2009, delisted in 2012, and relisted in 2014. So we have these back and forth shift. The public is getting confused a lot of times on, are they a federally endangered species? Are they a state managed species? And I think just that back and forth from overly protected to state-managed species, and in some cases perhaps more aggressive hunting than needed to be, but the drastic back and forth, I think, is creating a lot of concerns, a lot of confusion amongst the members of the public.
What would you like to see? What would be the ideal state of affairs going forward, at least for the next handful of years, when it comes to federal and state listing, culling, and hunting? What would you suggest is the ideal policy right now?
And I want to clarify that my statements represent my own views, mm-hmm. and not necessarily Northland College or the Sigurd Olson Institute where I work. But my preference would be to see wolves as a state-managed species, but the state to manage them in a fashion that allows control on problem wolves. Whether there is or is not a hunting season, I'm less concerned about. I think that should be something thoroughly discussed with all the stakeholders, and if a hunting season were to be considered, it should be done in a fashion so that the methods of hunting wolves are broadly accepted. It's during times of the year when it has least impact in the population, and it's done in a fashion so that it's sustainable, it maintains a healthy wolf population, and helps reduce some of the conflicts. But I guess my preference would be that they go back to a state-managed species and more flexible management be in place.
There have been concerns that if they are not protected under federal protections, we could see a state of affairs where political whims, maybe the vagaries of state politics, might lead to, I think you used the phrase, maybe too aggressive hunting of wolves. Is that a concern if they're delisted at the federal level?
Well, it's a concern from the standpoint of that it creates a process that doesn't have a lot of public support, and wolves are being removed from areas where we don't need to remove wolves. So there's questions about the level of sustainability. But from what we've seen, even though there was a fairly aggressive hunting season in Wisconsin, it did not endanger wolves. It reduced the population somewhat. So I'm less concerned about a hunting season endangering wolves again as to creating a lot additional concerns over how wolves are being managed and perhaps affect where wolves can live and where they can't live, that it may reduce some of those places. And it creates a lot of negative attitudes toward the state government by those who want to see wolves better protected. So I think an overly aggressive harvest can have a lot of problems, but the harvests that have been done thus far have not endangered the population.
What do you see as the status of the wolf population in Wisconsin now in terms of numbers? Are the numbers sustainable in terms of habitat and in terms of range? Are the numbers we have able to spread over a wide enough range to keep them going sustained into the future?
Well, we have a very healthy wolf population. When we started monitoring in 1980, we counted 25 wolves, and even 10 years later, when I started working with wolves in 1990, we counted 34 wolves. Last year, our count was about 750 wolves, and we anticipate this year the count will probably be at least as high and perhaps even higher without any hunting season this last year. I think we're well in the range of the numbers that can be supported in the state. Current levels are a very healthy population. We're starting to see wolves have impacts on ecosystems. So at levels where we currently are suitable, if it's a little bit less or a little bit more, it doesn't make a lot of difference. I think if they're drastically reduced, that would be of concern. If they're allowed to spread over much larger areas, it becomes an issue that the good habitat is pretty much saturated. Where wolves are moving into are going to be more developed landscapes where there's a lot more farming, where there are people living with their pets, and there's much higher risk of conflict. So maintaining a population closer to our current level would be desirable.
Adrian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Rob Ferris' interview with wildlife biologist Adrian Wideven on the impact of wolf hunts in the state of Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out this week. Coming up, it's Latino USA. Tonight, a look at some of the political stories that aren't as obvious from the difference in coverage between English and Spanish language reporting to why it's hard to accurately gather data about Latinos. Plus, a report on the overlooked state races in Florida. That's tonight at 7 on Latino USA. First, this weekend, the United States suffered the deadliest terror attack on U.S. soil since September 11th. The shooter opened fire at a popular LGBT club in Orlando, killing 49 and injuring more than 50 people. This weekend also marked a disturbing trend in domestic terrorism, the use of the high-capacity semi-automatic rifle, in the case of the Orlando shooter, a Sig Sauer MCX rifle. Furthermore, mass shootings and terrorism have also seemingly shifted from high-profile targets like government buildings to soft targets like a nightclub or a movie theater, as we saw this weekend. Joining us now to talk about this weekend's shooting and how terror is evolving is James Allen Fox. He's the Lippmann Family Professor of Criminology, Law, and Public Policy at Northeastern University. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, a recent Washington Post article pointed to the convergence of terrorism and what its author called American-style mass shootings. Are mass shootings uniquely American?
No, there are mass shootings in other countries, England, Germany, virtually anywhere around the world. Of course, we have more than our fair share, so we don't have a monopoly, but we certainly have cornered the market on it, unfortunately. I want to say one thing at the start here, based on your opening. I think we're all too quick to call these incidents terrorism. Terrorism is the use of violence or the threat of violence to gain some political or other kind of objective. These are individuals generally who aren't trying to advance an agenda. They're angry, bitter, hostile. They want to get even. They feel they've been mistreated somehow. And they want to get some justice. So it's not really terrorism because they're not looking for any cause.
Some would say that a goal of terrorism is to instill fear, and that could be a kind of agenda. Do you agree with that?
No. Well, fear for what purpose? I mean, if you terrorists want us fearful so that we change our lifestyle, inconvenience ourselves like we do in our airports, for some greater purpose. Just instilling fear for fear's sake is not really terrorism. It creates terror, of course, as one synonym of fear. But terrorism is use of violence for some instrumental purpose.
So how would you describe, what words would you use to describe what happened in Orlando?
Rampage. Rage. Now, obviously, and hate, of course. Now, in that case, because he may have identified with jihadist ideology, though he certainly wasn't involved in any terror cell, that may also be incidental. I mean, for example, the Columbine shooters, they were a big fan of Adolf Hitler. They knew nothing about Nazi ideology, but they identified with the power that he represented. In the same way that many people, like this individual, perhaps, identified with the power of ISIS to make himself feel powerful.
So when you look at similar terror attacks of a kind, the San Bernardino shooting, the shootings in Paris at the Bataclan and the coffee shops, how are you defining that? Are you defining that as terrorism?
Yes. I mean, there certainly are some mass killings that are for the sake of some agenda. I mean, and it doesn't necessarily have to be international terrorism. Obviously, the Oklahoma City bombing, although it was a shooting, it was a mass murder, is a form of terrorism to advance a cause. And the Unabomber, although that was more of a serial killing, is a terrorist because he was trying to advance his anti-technology agenda. But most mass killers, they don't have any higher purpose. They want payback. They want to get even. Now, most of them selectively go after certain individuals who they hold responsible for their problems. So a lot of the workplace shootings, for example, is a guy who's been fired and he goes back and kills the boss and all the coworkers. Many mass killers go after specific groups of people, not individuals. So Mark Lapine, for example, in Montreal hated feminists, thought they were taking away all of men's jobs. So he went to the engineering school, told the men to leave the classroom, and then executed the 14 women that were left behind. It's not that he wanted to kill women, because he could have done more damage at the nursing school. He wanted a certain kind of woman. There are the Long Island railroad shooter who was trying to get even with middle class whites. So there are a number of cases of mass killings that are hate crimes directed towards women or Jews or gays or blacks or immigrants or whites. And then the rarest form of mass killing is the purely random attack, such as the Aurora Theater shooting, where he's not targeting any particular group of people or any particular person, just basically a rampage against society.
The Washington Post article that we started off with was talking about a convergence of a move toward guns.
Yep.
in attacks like these. It may be in an incident that you might call terrorism at the San Bernardino, mm-hmm. the Paris attacks, instead of what you might have seen in the past, which was maybe more explosive devices. Are you seeing that guns are being increasingly used as the weapon of choice?
Well, I haven't calculated how many use explosives versus guns, but certainly one of the advantages of a gun for many of these shooters is they get the satisfaction of standing back and watching their victims die one by one, as opposed to a bomb where you may not see anybody actually get killed. So there's a certain psychological element, a power element, to gunning down your victims as opposed to an explosive.
And moving forward, I mean, what might that mean in America as we look at increasingly moving to what you might call soft targets instead of a government building, a military base? So how would guns change the calculations there?
Well, you know, even a military base is, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a hard target. You know, we saw in the Fort Hood shooting sprees that even though it's a military base, doesn't mean everybody's walking around armed. Same thing with the government building. So there are a lot of soft targets around the country. The only difference is in case, say, again, such as the McVeigh bombing, his specific agenda was to get back at the government. And other mass killers are looking for other kinds of targets at their workplace. And in fact, most mass killers actually kill within the family. They kill the wife and all the kids. But that's a different kind of mass killing. But they're all mass killings, certainly.
And how would you process what, if anything, is different about what we're seeing both in Orlando and in other recent shootings like the San Bernardino shootings?
Well, the thing that's different, of course, is the identification with ISIS. Most mass killings have nothing to do with politics. They're more personal agendas, personal revenge. In this case, in the Orlando case, you know, we're hearing a lot of talk about his frequenting the club many times and going online looking for men. So there may also be a psychological element as well. And in fact, that may even be more critical in deciding where he went to commit the crime.
So you've talked about the words rage and rampage, and there's the certain element that we don't really know the full story here, the extent that this might be something that was personal, having to do with maybe his sexuality, his mental situation, or whether there's any affiliation with ISIS. But given that, and that this is another mass shooting in America, how do we move to prevent this kind of thing?
Well, it's rather difficult to prevent, no matter what strategy we think of. Let's also keep in mind that these are very rare events, and they're not on the rise. We've had, on average in the United States, about 20 mass shootings of 4 more people killed a year, 20 a year, for the past 30 years. Hasn't been any increase or decrease. Sure, there's been some years where there have been spikes, the 2012, which had the Aurora shooting, as well as Sandy Hook, as well as the Omaha shopping mall. But then numbers went down in the following year. So some years there are spikes, and some years there are fewer. But there's no particular trajectory. The reason why people think that mass killings and mass shootings are on the rise is the nature of how the media can cover these crimes. If you go back a couple of decades, when we had just as many, you didn't have all the satellite trucks and the cable news channels able to carry these crimes live, beaming them into your living room, high-definition television, making it feel like it's happening just down the street.
But are they worse now? This was the worst attack like this on American soil.
Well, this one, in terms of the victim count of a shooting, sure it was. But if you make a list of the double-digit shootings, we had double-digit shootings in the 40s in Camden, New Jersey, in the 60s in Austin, Texas, the 70s and the 80s. We had early 80s, there were 2 cases of 13 people shot to death. So to some extent, you know, this obviously is an aberration. It's the largest. It's not the largest mass killing. Let's also keep that in mind. The Happy Lands fire in New York City, 87 were killed by an arsonist, and of course the McVeigh killing of over 160.
James Allen Fox is with us right now. He's the Lippmann Family Professor of Criminology, Law, and Public Policy at Northeastern University. And we're talking about mass shootings, terrorism, and what form attacks are taking these days in the wake of the deadly attack in Orlando this weekend at a popular LGBT nightclub. And we want to hear from you. What are your thoughts following this weekend's shootings? How should we move to address mass shootings? Do you think the media is to blame for making us feel a certain way about them, maybe feeling that they're on the rise? What do you think? Call us at 800-642-1234 or join the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue with James Allen Fox in just a moment here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about the form that violence, like this weekend's attack in Orlando, what form that violence is taking and what might be changing right now. And we want to hear from you. What would you like to see change when it comes to mass shootings in the country? What policies would you like to see put in place? And do news reports of attacks like the one about Pulse make you think twice about going to some public places, or do you think it's been overplayed in the media? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with James Allen Fox. He's a Lippmann Family Professor of Criminology, Law, and Public Policy at Northeastern University. And James, in your book, Extreme Killing, you talk about how some murderers are becoming accustomed to violence through the media. So what role do you think the media plays in incidents like Orlando and others of recent years?
Well, I don't believe that the media encourages killers. Yeah, there is a copycat element to some extent, but all the other conditions have to be there. It's not as if someone sees a shooting at a gay club in Orlando and decides, oh, I think I'm going to do the same thing. But if all the other conditions are there, then there are situations where people will pattern their behavior after another perpetrator. And we saw in the 80s a whole string of Pulse shootings, each one uttering the names of their predecessors. And in the 90s, we saw a whole string of school shootings by disgruntled students, each one patterning their behavior after someone else. So there is copycatting, but I wouldn't blame the media too much there. But where the media does come into play is overplaying the risk, and also the fact that if you watch the news the other day, I was watching CNN, every third sentence they said this was the largest mass shooting in American history, as if it would not be as tragic if it wasn't the largest. I'm not sure that matters. And also, when we start talking about records and largest and worst, well, records are there to be broken, and unfortunately, that might speak to some other people who want to break the record. We know, for example, that Adam Lanza, at the Sandy Hook shooting, he wanted to outdo his hero, which was the Anders Breivik, the shooter from Norway who killed 77.
If we're talking about violence of historic context, isn't it worth mentioning? Doesn't it point maybe to changes that need to be made to bring people's attention to the fact that something is gone horribly wrong, and maybe the government needs to address it, maybe society needs to address it, maybe we need to be talking about things?
Well, I think we would talk about it whether it was a record or not. That's the point. I mean, let's say 31 were killed. Well, that's not a record, and would it mean we would ignore it? And then back in the 80s, you said, you know, things are getting worse. Well, in the 80s, yes, we had a shooting with 21 were killed at a McDonald's restaurant. And then in the early 90s, there were 23 people killed at a restaurant in Texas. So, yes, yeah, this is maybe the largest, but I don't see any particular trend that says, oh, it's just spiraling out of control, because it's not.
Let's take a caller now. We have Dan on the line in Eau Claire. Dan, hi.
Hi. Great discussion, and I concur with your commentator's thoughts that it's going to be very difficult to prevent, unfortunately, these events. But I think maybe we could benefit from taking a different position by trying to control it. And what I mean by that is in many of these settings, be it schools or churches that if there was a trained, qualified person in that crowd that was security akin to the air marshals on flights that could help control or mitigate it, you may not eliminate it, but you could dramatically reduce the carnage, I think.
Well, that, it's possible, of course. That's one argument that people want to make, that if more of us had guns, then we could intervene. But keep in mind that the Columbine High School had armed guards. Now, obviously, it was a very large school, and it couldn't be everywhere. And one of the problems with the notion that having more citizens concealed weapons would be beneficial is that the killers, they always say how the killer was smiling. He was so cool and calm. Of course he's calm and cool because he knew he was coming. He was planning this for weeks. The rest of us are caught by surprise. And the mayhem that can occur if let's say, for example, the theater shooting in Aurora, if a bunch of people started pulling out guns and shooting wildly in a darkened theater, it could be a lot of people could be caught in the crossfire. So it's not clear whether that would make us safer. Possibly in certain cases, and there have been cases of masked gunmen who've been overtaken by someone, but there are other cases where it would make it worse. And if you think about a club, I mean, I know in the state of Florida, they have concealed carry rights, but one of the exceptions is any place where alcohol is served, because clearly alcohol and guns don't mix very well. But I wouldn't see, for example, if they were allowed to have a gun, a whole bunch of people dancing with their skinny jeans packing heat. Wouldn't happen.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us. We're going to go next to Bob in Grafton. Bob, hi.
Hi, Professor. Quite good. I'm a former intelligence officer, and the contrast between insurgencies and terrorism and the way you divided up terrorism between those who are, be polite, mentally ill and the terrorism from the outside, it was quite good.
Mm-hmm.
There are techniques to do it. Insurgency, we had the Phoenix program, but other similar type of ideas. But probably what we need is to ramp up our mental health expenditures to help those people who would do us harm.
You know, that's the right thing to do, but for the wrong reason. Do we really need to have a mass killing to say that we need to improve our mental health services? And one of the problems with that is, for example, Obama went to Connecticut right after the Sandy Hook shooting, and he said, we need to do something to help the mentally ill before it's too late. Now, the question is, are we doing it because we're concerned about the well-being of the mentally ill, or are we doing it because we're concerned about the well-being of the people they may shoot? And if it's the latter, then we're really just adding to the stigma about being mentally ill and confusing it with mass murder and mentally ill together. Plus, what's true about mass killers is they don't think they need help. They want treatment, but they want fair treatment. They don't want psychological treatment because they see themselves as victims of injustice. When things go wrong in their lives, they blame other people. So most of the people who have gone on these rampages would not take you up on the offer. But still, we should do it anyway. And if mass killings can motivate us to do the right thing, then that's wonderful. But let's do it for the right reason.
Bob, thank you so much for that call. And James, just very briefly before we wrap up here, mm-hmm. Are there changes that you would like to see?
Are there changes? Well, sure. I would like to see expanded mental health treatment, but not necessarily because it will solve the mass murder problem. I would like to see a variety of sensible gun control measures, because that would impact the kind of gun crime that we have every day on the streets of America. Will it impact mass killings? No. Mass killer, I mean, for example, background checks. Most of them pass a background check because they don't have a criminal record or a history of psychiatric treatment. And even if they didn't pass a background check, there's certainly many ways they can get their gun by beg, borrowing, or stealing it. They're very determined they'll find one. So if we can get better gun control because of these killings, that's great. But again, it's the right thing to do, but not for this reason.
James, thank you so much for joining us. It was James Allen Fox, Lippman Professor of Criminology, Law, and Public Policy at Northeastern University. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret's out this week. You're listening to Central Time.